talking about war. And I should also add that in the next hour and a half, I hope to be on the point. I hope to be able to fill you in on the broad developments. Now, David has set the picture very, very strongly for us of the situation of development through the 17th century and beyond. Some of the rationales behind the development of the cult of St. Margaret and setting that into a wider spiritual but also social and economic context. And it's with that aspect that I really want to begin. David started shortly after the beginning of the reign of Alexander III in 1249 with the great ceremony for the translation. 1286, the next thing is the funeral of that same young king, well, no longer young, but that same king, Alexander III, who had come a cropper on his ride back from his overindulgent drinking session with his mates in Edinburgh, and determination to get back to his delightful new young wife at the Royal Manor of Kinghorn, and his enthusiasm to get back to produce the heir that he was so desperate to have. He's thrown from his horse and he believes, though he knows exactly what happened, but his body was then found on the foreshore. This is the event that for basically most of the next 600 to 700 years was taken as marking the end of a great golden age in Scotland's history. This king who presided over Scotland that lived in peace and stability when it reached the maximum of its earlier medieval extent for the acquisition of Orkney and Shetland in the 15th century, who presided over an era of wine and wax and gin and glee, as the poem tells us. But what we begin to see is an idea of an abundance that turns very rapidly with the king's death into disaster, into decay, into decline, into war, the threat of invasion and then conquest by England. But when we start to scratch at the surface, we find almost immediately that this picture of abundance is not quite all it was set out to be. Yet, there is ample evidence for expansion in the economy. You've got the great burgeoning of the amount of silver that's in circulation. The kingdom, Scotland's trade, on the back of a European boom, is doing relatively well, certainly in the earlier parts of Alexander III. Towards the end, there may have been slightly less certainty. The population is expanding rapidly. This is one of the things that you can see from the archaeological and the place-name evidence after the documentary record, that all across Scotland, in all the areas that could possibly manage it, you're pushing agriculture to the absolute maximum. The climate, by the beginning of the 13th century, is reaching its optimum period of what's known as the medieval warm, medieval climate anomaly, or the medieval warm period. So, you can begin to move into areas that might be regarded as marginal in the century and a half before, and will soon become marginal again. People are feeling good. There is prosperity around. People feel good, they breed. Families are getting bigger. That is more mouths to feed. You start to see more communities splitting and moving out to establish further outlying farms. All of the time, expansion, producing more demand in the market. And Dunfermline, as the owner of a largely arable estate, is a beneficiary from that. This is an estate that they have been receiving in gifts, built up over, really from the 1090s onwards. Now petering out somewhat as you move into the 13th century as, a favour say, royal favour moving to other institutions. But you're looking at an estate by the middle of the 13th century that includes outposts in Murray, and I'm not just talking about a minor thing, this is one of the biggest salmon fishing stations in northern Scotland. So income coming from salmon fishery in the north attached to the Pride of Urquhart up there at Spema. You have got all through Fife, you've got through Stinpercha, you've got through parts of Southern Angus. You have got control, not just of the borough here kingdom down, but you have got the rising borough of Kirkcaldy. You have got the interest in Musselburgh, all down the Firth of Forth. This is an abbey that has got a substantial base to fall back upon in bad times. And it is out of this resource, many hawking themselves to a fair extent to be able to afford it, but it is out of the revenue that they're getting through this that they are funding the reconstruction of the church in the early decades of the 13th century. Now, we know little, if we're honest with ourselves, about the origins of medieval Dunfermline, other than that this is effectively the suburb to the older royal establishment on the other side of the Tower Burn. But at the gates of the abbey, you get the development of the market community that survives. And although we have got no formal evidence for the grant of a charter to it, perhaps they are just simply assuming that as the direct successor of that failing royal borough, they have got the right to continue to trade in this way. But there is a market, and that development at the Abbey Gate is exactly the same kind of development that you see happening at Arbroath, at Whithorn, at Melrose, at Paisley. And it is because you have got an estate that is producing certain kinds of surplus produce, the byproducts of the great estate that can be used and processed. These people are the Abbey dependents. These people are paying rent. These people are effectively being creamed to provide income to the Abbey. So at the gates, you have a community that is doing, well, perhaps not abundantly greatly. It is not certainly up there in the realms of an Edinburgh or a Perth at this time. But it is doing sufficiently good to allow the abbot to continue to consider investing in this community. It's this relationship with the abbey that gives it this unique selling points, if you like. And although, as David said, we've got no clear evidence for the provision of a service sector within the borough to deal with the pilgrims, we just need to look at the equivalent that's taking place through the later 13th and the 14th century in boroughs such as Whithorn, where the whole evolution of that borough in the early 14th century is designed entirely to provide for the large numbers of pilgrims flocking to the shrine estate in Indian down there. And in the gateway from the priory leading up to the shrine estate, you've got the development of a market, which is selling knick-knacks, selling all little bits and pieces. You know, I can guarantee you that this is the bone of St. Ninian. I can give you this little pewter badge. Okay, we don't have the evidence for any of those things being produced in Dunfermline. But it is the same kind of market-driven mentality. These people need to be fed. They need to be clothed. And you're not going to get it all within the Abbey precinct. If you want to have a reasonable quality experience, the good burgesses of Dunfermline were prepared to offer something of that kind. Now, the picture that we have then is a community benefiting from its physical location, it's benefiting from the great agglomeration of property around it. It has got an estate that stretches up into the Cleish Hills. It has got room for expansion. And just as down slightly before the head of Lauderdale, you're seeing this expansion that I was referring to at the beginning. The ephemeral traces, these white lines in the snow still lying in the bottoms of what were the plough furrows between the great rigs for agriculture. You can still see traces of this up and over the Cleish Hills, down past Cleish itself, out towards Tullyhaul on the other side, where you've got medieval agricultural expansion into relatively marginal ground. So this is providing increasing rent. This is providing, very importantly, given that the family controls nearly all the parish churches in this area, it is also giving additional keen income to these places. So you're seeing that source of revenue being augmented through the 13th century. It is, as I was saying, largely as a consequence of this income that they're able to take the loans, I guess, with no evidence for it, but it's probably loan income paid for on promises of sales of future wool, perhaps, or on the income from the monastic estates that allows for the great expansion of the church in the 13th century. Sadly, that portion of the church, which was largely destroyed by the collapse of the central tower, and also because it was, well, the most redundant bit in a Protestant society. You don't want all these nasty, sinful things tainting good Protestant worship. But this picture of boom and expansion has got to be tempered with the other side of the coin. And even within the medieval record, if we actually had really opened our eyes and looked at it and questioned this idea of Alexander's reign, of time of abundant, perpetually good harvests, we see the record in there. Actually, from the 1250s onwards, we've got it. 1268, 1272, references to things going disastrously wrong. Winters of extreme severity. You've got crop failures. You have got long, long periods of poor weather with the deaths of animals in number. Wild animals and domesticated animals. And in both of these areas, you're seeing, again, a direct economic impact coming through. So what is actually going on? Well, what seems to be the case is that the long era of climatic relative stability that we've seen through the 12th and into the beginning of the 13th century, marked by this peak here, is beginning to slide in the 13th century. Things are becoming much less comfortable climatically, and we're seeing the development of a weather pattern very similar to what we've been experiencing at present. What we have is a world where atmospheric change seems to be helping to precipitate large weather changes. So it's climate change leading to weather change. Now, this is when I was a student up at St. Andrews, wonderful sunsets in 1981 as a result of the great eruption of Mount St. Helens. People wondered at these beautiful skies at night, but didn't actually really give much credit to what it was doing in terms of global air circulation and what it meant in terms long term of changes to the weather. And we know that in the 13th century, we have got similar major volcanic eruptions that are throwing up huge amounts of sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere. And these basically provide seeding, if you like, for increased rainfall, or they provide the circumstances for the beginning of a depression in temperatures. And so we see, particularly in the Greenland area, the development of phases of intense coldness. What is happening up here in Greenland, all those hundreds of miles away up to the northwest, affect us directly. And in the 13th century, most Scots would have been completely oblivious to the fact of what was going on, which was that cooling up in that polar district was leading to an extension of sea ice, which was cooling the waters of part of the North Atlantic, but at the same time, you're seeing a heating of another part of the North Atlantic, throwing up large amounts of moisture into the atmosphere. And what you start to see is cold air getting drawn further south, meeting the warm, moist air moving from the south eastwards across the Atlantic. When the two collide, the result is winters like we've had over the last few years. Large areas of high pressure sitting over northwest Greenland, sitting over the north of Scotland, meeting warm, wet air coming in off the Atlantic, and the result was snow. The result was late springs, just like we've had this year. The result was long, wet summers, just like we have had over the last few years also. Delayed harvests. Now, in these days, we have got the joy of different approaches to corn drying and things of that kind. In the Middle Ages, you relied on things like peat. Peat, of course, which you need to dry before you can burn. But, of course, if it's been raining for the entire summer, that luxury has been taken away from you. And so an agricultural estate, an agricultural population, such as Dunfermline was relied upon, these people are being faced with failure of their harvest, with failure of their economy. And so they are looking increasingly at a life that is moving towards subsistence and marginality, if not downright collapse. Now, there's your background to what's going on. There's the reality of Alexander III's golden age. It was definitely not golden. Golden for some people, golden for the people who had access to the surpluses, people who could profit from the fact that folks had to pay more to get their food, they were having to buy on the market, they were having to import where possible. But for much more of the population, it is life on the margin. Then you've got to add into all of this uncertainty, all of this social pressure, all of this economic uncertainty, political change is coming along, political crisis. Alexander's dead. His heir, no question, is his granddaughter Margaret, who's over in Norway. Great arrangements are made to bring her back. Alexander's suggested possibility of a marriage to the heir, to Edward I of England, to Edward of Carnarvon, that gets put into operation, and regardless of what Edward's machinations behind this were, the Scots entered into that agreement as the best way forward. And then, with all these great efforts put together to prepare for this future union that would stabilise the British Isles, the ungrateful little bitch goes and dies. And you're left with this situation where, when the Scots envoys are heading north to receive their new queen who's coming over from from Norway through Orkney to come down, they get to Skelbo when word reaches them that she is dead. And you have just got uncertainty. Now, out of that uncertainty emerges what's known as the great cause. Out of that uncertainty, you get the moving in of Edward I of England to capitalise where possible on the situation. He very, very quickly is asked to preside over the debate about who shall be the next King of Scots. And what he does is he eventually manoeuvres the would-be candidates, the so-called competitors, into a situation where he wants to be included in the bid to become the next King of Scots. You've got to recognise, first and foremost, that I'm your Lord Superior. So if you don't recognise me as your Lord Superior, well, what's your chance of ever becoming the King? Once you've got that, the Scots nobility, the Scots church, who are trying to keep them at bay, have got to cave in. Edward is accepted as Lord Superior in Scotland, takes a quick jaunt up through the Lothians, crosses over, stops off at Dunfermline, because Dunfermline, regardless of what its precarious political and economic situation may have been, is still one of the largest monasteries and capable of accommodating even what would have been a relatively small moving retinue of the King of England. It is the place to stop over. He moves on up through Fife, round the Perth, back down. He's done his tour, he's received submissions. This is going to be the place that you have got the beginnings of the acceptance of Edward as his right to preside in this contest. Now, out of that contest, you get the establishment of John Baliol and the rightful King of Scots. And regardless of later Bruce propaganda, if you go on a strict application of the rules, which is ultimately what is done, John Baliol is the rightful King of Scots. The Bruces are a subsidiary line there, one step further removed. So it's John Baliol who's the rightful King. Now, that's where it stops, really, because John, regardless of right, is actually not really cut out to be king, not a strong personality. He hadn't even been intended to inherit the Balliol estates and titles. He was a younger son, probably had originally been destined for the church. But he is somebody who, as he later described himself, a lamb amongst wolves. He finds himself outmaneuvered by Edward, who, having promised that he wouldn't interfere in Scotland's domestic affairs, consistently interferes in Scotland's domestic affairs. He is really humiliating John, interfering in his running of justice within his own realm, the kinds of things that a king is expected to be able to demonstrate that he is the fountain of justice within his own realm. And John is being summoned to answer for his judgments at Edward's court. This is a situation which the Scots nobility will not tolerate any longer. It is an erosion of their interests. And ultimately, executive power is taken out of John's hands, and a treaty is negotiated with the French. Now, no matter what nice spin you put on this, Edward is not going to look on this as a particularly friendly act, given that he is about to slide into war with France. This is a hostile move, and the Scots welcome it with open arms, and it is at Dunfermline once again that you get the assembly of the Scottish nobility to ratify the treaty, and that precipitates the war with England. And just in case people still think it's Edward the First who invaded Scotland, actually no, we invaded England first. But as usual, we completely and utterly copied it up. Now, as I said, you might notice I've moved from 1296 all straight through to 1303, because Dunfermline, almost immediately, having leapt onto the scene in 1296, disappears again from the scene in 1296. We've got no evidence for it playing any significant role during the Wallace guardianship, that first reopening of the fighting after the defeat of the Scots in 1296. You've got wholesale submissions taking place. You've got the tale that appears in Blind Harry of William Wallace having murdered Selby, the governor of Dundee's son, coming down through Dunfermline on his way someplace out west. But there's no evidence that ever occurs other than the minds of Harry the minstrel. But where we do see Dunfermline re-emerging is in the early 1300s, and it is surprisingly, wonderfully, if you want, in English sources. And this is where we really get driven home to us the significance of this place. The author of the English Chronicles, known as the Flores Historiarum, no longer, used to be attributed to a guy called Matthew of Westminster, but he's a complete fabrication. We're not entirely sure who put this together. But we get told there are in Scotland two most famous abbeys. Now, this is important for the mentality of the world beyond Scotland. They recognise two major monasteries in Scotland at this time. Most abundant in their offices and most well fortified in their buildings, namely Arbroath, no surprises there, and Dunfermline. But Dunfermline within its precincts is very large, containing three carucates of land, 360 acres apparently, which is not true, containing almost regal palaces within it, so that three renowned kings with their followers, each without clashing with the others, are at the same time and in the same manner able to be accommodated. So we've got Dunfermline being really brought forward as this great, great centre capable of housing the retinues of three kings. Now the precinct may not have been 660 by 660 yards necessary to have that 360 acre enclosure within it, but it was still a major territory, about half that size, extending out beyond the abbey to the east. So stretching south from the Maygate, Camel Street, right down to the Lithocritton Creek Glen, and west to, from Kirkgate Line. Basically, it's the back line, the back dyke line of the property running down New Road. So it's a big piece of ground. Anyway, its role as a meeting place of the Scottish community, particularly Scotland 96, that might have been something that grounds its place into English mentality. And it's because of this capacity to get this foreign historian telling us that, you know, the greater men of the kingdom of Scotland were accustomed to gather there and to hatch plots against the king of the English. And generally in time of war, they were haunted by those plotting theft, plunder and murder against the English people. That's Mount Vernon for you. The English army, therefore, being the temple of the Lord, not as a church, but as a den of thieves. And almost, as it were, a stake in the eye of the English people. Sending a column of soldiers, it utterly leveled to the ground the ditches, walls, palaces, sparing from the flames only the church and a few houses suitable for the monks. So Dunfermline, we are told, is burned. And it goes on, even the church is plundered of all its fixtures and fittings. But it can't actually be that bad, because Edward was able to base himself there from 11th November 1303 to the 4th March 1304. He's overwintering in Scotland. He's able to accommodate as well the household of the Prince of Wales also. Now, this again is a sign of the scale of the monastery. We can look at the English wardrobe accounts, we can look at Edward's records and see him performing here all the actions of a great royal court and household, the English court and the English writing office. The bureaucracy is there with the king. He is able to send out instructions from here. He's holding courts and decisions and councils here, accommodated within Dunfermline Abbey. When he leaves, that's when he burns. It's not his purpose. But ironically, given the fact that he's just supposedly devastated this place, he also is setting out to win friends and influence people. He is using his control of patronage to win large numbers of Scots, influential Scots, over to his side. This is in the period when you're moving towards, after February 1304, you're beginning to move towards a settlement that is going to see, ultimately in 1305, the production of England, the ordinance of the government of Scotland, the two realms incorporated into one realm, the Kingdom of England. But the abbot seizes this opportunity of Edward having to suck up to these people that he wants to bring in by petitioning. And interestingly, no petition concerning Dunfermline itself. It's Kirkcaldy, and it is Musselburgh that are bid for. And he is getting the charters for the markets and the rights for fairs in these communities, and also the very useful privilege of the right to vulnerable property, the goodies that you can get, the income you can get from control of things like rabbit warrens and the hunting of rabbits. Now, moving hopefully rapidly towards the conclusion, despite this, in the summer of 1305, this church that has already been heavily damaged in the earlier course of the war, and the English are besieging Stirling Castle right at the end, the last place to be holding out in the name still of King John Baliol. The lead is stripped from the roof of the great church in central Scotland. They get credit notes saying they're going to pay for it. We've got no evidence that they ever actually did, but it's probably this act, more than any English occupation in 1304, that means the large-scale damage to the buildings. When Robert becomes king, when Robert becomes king, he has to try and turn the clock back in some ways with this community. He has got to try to re-establish a firm identity for himself and legitimise his lineage, legitimise his right, go back to Alexander III and the earlier kings who identify closely with this place. And so he favours Dunfermline. One of the first kings who start to show great favour to Dunfermline, really since the 12th century. And the royal household is resident here frequently. We've got dates of when the king was issuing charters, but most importantly, here, in early 1324, that the future David II is born. here, I've really run out of time. What I wanted to say is that through this period, you've also got another run into climatic deterioration. This is when they are needing every bit of support that the king can give them. We're back into the severe winters, we're back into an era of disaster in which you have got evidence of cannibalism, of suggestions of cannibalism all across Northern Europe. We've got the loss of potentially 10% of the population as a result of famine at this time. The economy on which Dunfermline had based its wealth in the 12th and 13th centuries is really beginning to fall apart, devastated by cattle moraines, devastated by sheep diseases, which lead to wasting of the fleeces, loss of income taking place there. They're adding petitions regularly and get gifts of things like additional churches, Kinross and in healing, that provide it with additional income. This is an attempt to try and bolster falling revenues, falling economy. Robert also paid substantially for the rebuilding of the monastery, a sign of his favour to this community and a sign of his new crown. Everything seems to be finally returning to that golden age that we had back in time of Alexander III. But just around the corner, fortunately, I'm not going to talk about it at all, we've got a new era of war, famine, disease and death, as 14th century Scotland slides into the worst disaster ever faced by the people of Scotland.